last few months, we've done some discussions on the Indian Ocean, the Pacific, China, and there's a certain country that keeps coming up over and over again, and we decided it's been a while since we've talked about Russia, and so we wanted to bring back a prior guest who I think is just the right person to talk to with some of the changes that we've had over in the world's largest landmass country in a while. Our guest for the entire hour will be Dr. Dmitry Gorenberg. He is the Senior Analyst, CNA Strategic Studies, and Associate at Harvard's Davis Center of Russian and Eurasian Studies. He's an author, and he also hosts the required reading Russian Military Reform blog. Dmitry, welcome to Midrats.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. Something you shared with me here a couple of weeks ago is you just come back from the Baltics. I know they've had a real tough winter up there, but how is springtime in the Baltics?
It was very nice. We had a great conference in Tartu on Russian and Eurasian regional security issues with the PONARS group, and it was quite lovely.
And I just wanted to pull the thread on there because we just kind of talked about our favorite Baltic countries. One of my former colleagues, he's now a Luftwaffe brigadier, but he did his war college over at the Baltic War College, and his eyes would always glaze over when you would ask him about that because he was a perpetual bachelor. They have the most beautiful women. He really was impressed with the Baltic women. I'm a big fan of the Estonians for a variety of reasons, because the big surprise that I had when I went there was I'd spent a little time in St. Petersburg, and people in St. Petersburg will tell you, back in the time of the Soviet Union, they would drive to Tallinn for dinner, so to speak, because it's not that far away. But there's a big difference in feel, a big difference in mood. And some of my Estonian military colleagues always want to tell me that the minute they had a chance, they went back to the happy country of Sweden to go visit. There is something different about the Baltics, even though, especially those that have a real large Russian ethnic population. What are their biggest concerns now in the last few years with regard to Russia and how Russia continues to evolve, both from their own personal national security perspective, but also that economic integration?
Well, it's interesting. I was I hadn't been to the Baltics for about 10 years between I was there in 2002 and then this trip now, and my sense was that the population, at least the people you're talking to, are just much calmer about Russia. 10 years ago, I think there was still a lot of anxiety among, and I'm talking obviously about the titular population, the Estonians, the Latvians, and so forth. That they had a sense, they still had a fear that, Russia might come back. And that, I think, now that they're in the EU, they're in NATO, that has really calmed down. And so people are happier to speak Russian than they were then. There's still, certain issues, but I think the Russian-speaking minorities in those countries are somewhat at least better integrated. There are more and more of them are citizens now. So that, from that kind of people-to-people kind of interaction, things seem much calmer. In terms of, sort of national strategy kind of issues, I didn't really have much of a chance to talk to the people who, in government this time, who do those kind of things. So I don't have a real good answer for you on what exactly they're worried about. But my sense is there's still, Estonia still in particular was kind of shaken by that whole cyber attack about 5 years ago after the Bronze Soldier monument was moved. I don't know if you recall that. But that was something where there was a kind of a concerted attack by Russian hackers on a lot of Estonian internet infrastructure, if you were. And I think that they've kind of focused on strengthening those capabilities, and they've really sort of taken on a role as trying to be the this goes in with the NATO summit and trying to specialize different countries in NATO into different things. Well, Estonia's taken on that cyber role for the last several years. So I don't know what I think. There's the economic links are still there, especially in Latvia, in terms of trade, in terms of transport of oil and so forth. So there's still a lot tying to the Baltics to Russia, and at the same time, they obviously don't want to be too close because of past history and so forth.
I want to head a little further south. Syria seems to have two friends in the entire world right now, and one of them seems to be Iran, and the other one is Russia. What is Russia's play in Syria? What is that all about?
I've been writing on this a bit. It's there's a lot of going on for Russia now. I should say I think there's a third friend, which is China. Don't forget, they people neglect them, but they do the usual Chinese thing of not saying a lot, but they're there. They're backing Russia up, and you know, in the UN and so forth. But as far as Russia is concerned, it's sort of multifactorial. There's obviously the interest in military sales and access to the naval facility in Tartus. And they are certainly worried that they would lose that if the opposition took over. And there's also, and I think the Libya experience plays a role here, because there's a sense that they were kind of betrayed on Libya, and that they supported the intervention and they didn't really get much for it, and now the transitional government, such as it is in Libya, is now looking to France to buy weapons rather than Russia, and so they're going to lose out, and they obviously don't want that to happen. The military side, there are other economic investments, but I don't think that's the major thing that's going on. There is, I think, more of a concern of kind of perception that the Russia's traditional allies, let's say, in the Middle East are kind of falling one by one, and there was kind of this axis back in the Soviet days. There was, you know, Syria and Iraq were very much the core of Russia, of the Soviet Union's support, and there was kind of an effort to rebuild that axis slightly differently, adding in Iran because it was opposed to the United States, and so that was kind of where Russian interests in the Middle East were heading over the last 10 years or so, and Libya was also in that. And so with Libya gone, Iraq gone, and the talk that they see of the potential for a U.S. military attack on Iran at some point in the future, they see this as all, some segment of the Russian political elite, let's say, and I don't think they're uniform on this, but some segment, and perhaps the dominant one, sees a plan for the U.S. to kind of dominate the Middle East in this way. And so they see what's going on in Syria not as a democratic, you know, peaceful democratic protest trying to create democracy and overthrow this bad guy, which is how, you know, there's a lot of the rest of the world might view it, but rather they see it as one. I don't know if you want to call it a religious division or a tribal division, but anyway, there's one segment of the population in Syria, perhaps the majority segment, trying to overthrow an existing government using whatever means are available, starting with peaceful uprisings and then going on to violent confrontation when the peaceful protests didn't work. And so they see this other group as now being supported by the West and by the United States, and they don't want that shift to happen. So I think that's at the core of the Russian support for Assad, and there's nothing in it now for them to switch sides, because again, the Libya lesson is that for them, from their point of view, that they're not going to get much in return if they switch sides and the other side comes to power.
The Russian, just to stick with the Middle East for a while, the Russians' interaction in the Middle East has always been kind of a quandary to me, because, you know, I go back to the, you know, what the Soviet Union was doing. It did make sense in the context of the West versus the Soviet Union context. And I've tried to look at it, you know, the old, I think we talked about it the last time we had your guest on, you know, you can't, at least I can't consider Russia a Western country or an Eastern country. It's really just Russia. So I've tried to look at it from the Russian perspective with their historical view of being surrounded and wanting friends and allies all over the place. They have a significant and radicalizing Muslim majority in their country. So I've also tried to look at it from them trying to make contacts in the Islamic world to somehow leverage some of their internal problems down the road. But then I get very perplexed when I look at their support for the Iranian nuclear program. Do they really look at their actions in the Middle East strictly as an external issue, or are some of the actions they're taking and the relationships they're trying to build in the Middle Eastern countries, are they looking at that in the context of some of their Islamic minority problems, not just the Chechens but the Tatars and other ones that they have internally, and how those two might interplay together down the road?
I think that's a lesser concern overall. I think there is a concern in terms of stability in Central Asia and the Caucasus. At this point, I don't think they're too worried about the most numerous minorities, which are in the Volga region, the Tatars, the Bashkirs, because those are fairly Russified. Not, you know, there are certainly a few radicals here and there, but it's, you know, they're not supported by the population, and it's not really not an issue. But where there is a problem is in the North Caucasus, obviously, and it's not, you know, you mentioned Chechens, it's now gone beyond that. It's no longer an ethnic thing. It's much more of a religious conflict, to the extent that it's still a conflict, and it's fueled by huge economic problems, and political problems, corruption, kind of a general sense of hopelessness among the youth in that area because of this combination of unemployment, lack of prospects, because all the potential employment is all connected to being linked to these elites through corrupt kind of patron-client networks. So a lot of the younger people who don't have those connections feel hopeless, and, you know, they find some salvation, if you want to use that word, in what's being taught by radical Islam. And so there's some small but not insignificant percentage of the population that goes that route and turns to in some cases to violence, and that they are worried about. I'm not sure to what extent it's linked to you mentioned the Iran nuclear program. I think that's a separate thing we can talk about. But it is linked to the fear of demonstration effects, let's say, from these Arab Spring kind of protests moving north, maybe initially into Central Asia, Azerbaijan, and then from there into Russia. So that is an issue. And it's hard to say where... You know, if I was ranking the different reasons for Russian policy in the Middle East, that one would probably come in, I don't know, third or so. But it's there. It is certainly there.
I heard someone, and I think it might have been on Fox News, so talking about it. But their argument about Russia is that with Putin and his seeming inability to leave government, that what we have is a return of the Russian dictatorship and if anything, a KGB kleptocracy in charge. Is that a reasonable assessment, or is there something else going on with their recent elections? Is there any possibility we'll see anything akin to what we would consider a Western democracy movement in Russia soon?
Well, there's a movement for it, obviously. There's a protest movement. How effective they are, I think, is unfortunately, it's fairly, that what they showed in the last couple months in the, around the presidential election is they really didn't have much of a game plan for what happened afterwards. So they're continuing protests and so forth, but it really has no effect. And, my sense increasingly now is that Putin is there for, however long he wants to be there, whether that's 6 years or 12 years or less than 6 years, we'll see. He could, decide to step down at some point. I think it's fairly unlikely before the end of at least the first term, but it's possible. He is, and Russia to me is a very much kind of a standard authoritarian state, as many other authoritarian states have been over the years. I wouldn't, it's not any different than, let's say, well, I mean, in the overall scheme of things, it's more similar than different than, let's say, Egypt under Mubarak was, or and even a number of other states that had elections and had an opposition that was allowed to function to some extent, but was constrained to a level where, they just made sure that they never actually got into power. And the danger comes for that kind of regime not from the protesters, the pro-democracy activists, but from within the elite. And this is why Putin can't leave. It's not that he may well want to leave, but there's no one else within the elite who can balance all those clans that have arisen over the last decade. And so anyone else who replaces him would come from one of those clans and would therefore be resisted by those clans, by the other clans, who would lose out. And so the danger comes in that eventually there will have to be a succession. And at that point, the clans, represent whoever the leaders are of the clans that are potentially losing out, could move to the opposition. And that's where you can have a situation where there's a change of regime that could result in democracy or might not. So Ukraine is actually a really good example of this. We had the Orange Revolution, which everyone around here at the time thought was a great democratic thing. But what it actually showed was that a bunch of people who had been in the elite, Yushchenko, Tymoshenko, but had fallen out. But had lost out in that transition, and so their clan had been eclipsed by Yanukovych's clan under Kuchma in Kuchma's last couple of years. Went over to the opposition and created a situation where they made the opposition viable essentially because of these elite splits, and so then they took over. But they were never able to consolidate, and so you had that kind of what to the outside world seemed to be democracy. It was actually two or three clans battling it out for who would be in charge. And now, I don't think Yanukovych has fully consolidated, but he's at least to some extent consolidated, and we see that with Tymoshenko in jail. So that's the kind of thing that we could see happening in Russia at some point if Putin became ill or stepped down for some other reason. I mean, he's still got a ways to go before he gets old. So that's kind of where I see the potential for transition coming from, not from the guys in the streets, unfortunately. But that's just the way I think it is.
You know, for obvious reasons, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, I mean, the Russian, you know, we all remember about 10 years ago when they bottomed out, the demographics and the numbers coming out of Russia was just society in collapse. But what we've seen in the last few years, the birth rate has risen back to where it was back in the early 90s after dropping really far in the low point around 2000-2001. And the death rate has started to come back down as well. You know, a little bit of good cultural numbers there. But when you break it out, you look at, you know, the regions of Russia that are seeing, you know, demographic change, especially the European side of Russia, in the areas in the Trans-Ural that are majority Russians, those areas is not where you've seen that demographic change recover so much. It's in where the non-Russians are. And you mentioned earlier how some of the, you know, minorities, they're pretty well Russianified, so to speak. So is a lot of people are looking at the continual demographic change is the fact that the ethnic Russians are treading water, so to speak, but the real growth rate is in the non-Russian populations. The Russian press, have they really started to digest the demographic, you know, winter they had in the last decade and how it's recovering and how the, you know, Russia, the youth of Russia is going to look like in about 20, 25 years compared to what it is right now?
I think the simple answer is no, they haven't. I think it's not things aren't even quite as, not that you painted a rosy picture, but they're not even that good, as you put out. The problem is there's still, you know, the birth rates are okay. Birth rates are not any different from the rest of Europe. They're sort of what you expect in modern societies. The problem is still the death rate. And you see that in very low, comparatively speaking, life expectancies. You still see, you know, less so than maybe in the 90s when things were bad, but you still see men dying in, you know, sort of prime working years, right? And the alcohol is still a problem. And all of those things are leading to, plus the fact that because the birth rate was so low for so long, the number of women who could potentially have children has decreased. So, you know, the prognosis for the population is still, you know, it's not as dire as I think people were saying 10 years ago, but it's still not great. And the only real way to keep a stable or increasing population is through immigration. And immigration means, by now, pretty much all the ethnic Russians from the former Soviet Union who wanted to come have come, by and large. So what this means is, you know, immigration of Tajiks and people from the Caucasus, and that leads to xenophobia. And that is something they haven't really figured out how to deal with. They're trying, you know, you see the government and political leaders trying to kind of play both sides of the coin here, where on the one hand they talk about tolerance and condemn violence, but they're also making little gestures to the kind of the Russian nationalists and the skinhead types who are attacking the minorities in Moscow. And that is something that they need to resolve in order to, you know, because economic growth is going to depend on immigration, really, even more so than on higher birth rates among non-Russian, the indigenous non-Russians. And they have, I don't think they've come to terms with that yet. You know, they may in the next 10 years, but it's gonna be tricky.
Well, that economic connection, the last issue of The Economist had a great little article infographic there that they're talking in general terms about remittances from the West and other countries to poorer countries around the world. I thought what was really surprising was I believe it was Turkmenistan and especially Kyrgyzstan, a significant part of their domestic economies rely on remittances that come from Russia. And, you know, those aren't really huge countries to speak of. So it appears that even though they're not officially immigrating, becoming citizens, that a lot of the labor already in Russia proper is coming from those Central Asian countries.
Yes, very much so. And it is, Tajikistan is the other one that's very much dependent on Russian remittances, in addition to the ones you mentioned. And that is very, very much the case. And I think it's very much along the same lines as we see in people from Latin America coming to the U.S. It's a very similar pattern in terms of how it functions with men coming initially, at least, to Russia to work, often, you know, going back and forth. Now, you know, it's easier, it's easier to go back and forth in Russia than it is in the United States. So they do that, but they send money back for their families. In the meantime, in some cases, they bring their families eventually, but I think the majority is kind of they come for some number of years, make a bunch of money, and then go back to their country of origin. So that is, I think that's something that's kind of there to stay for a while, as long as this, a lot of the menial jobs, construction and so forth, are now, especially in the bigger cities, are not jobs that the local inhabitants necessarily want to have at the wages at which, you know, they're being done. So that niche is being filled in by Central Asia.
I was interested in a couple of your blog posts that had to do with the way the Russians are looking at spending money toward their military. And one of them, you made the point that they're trying, somebody at least was proposing that they reduce the size of their army to save some money. And a lot of that seems to be driven by the price of oil and gas and their what they've had a kind of a monopoly on gas flow into Europe as the fracking of the gas in Poland and other places and gas maybe be flowing from some African countries up to Europe. Are the Russians going to come into desperate straits, do you think, as far as the money that they've been able to have up to now on this? Is this an issue where we may see them cut back? I think you said they might just go to a coastal fleet. You know, they've actually got four seas they have to deal with, but for, you know, a coastal fleet plus their nuclear triad submarines, or what do you foresee as far as where they're going to go from here with that?
Well, I think there's two parts here. Let me do the economic side first, and then I'll talk a little bit about the naval development. I think it's not, you know, they don't see it as quite that dire yet with the gas, and maybe that they're you know, there may be wishful thinking. I don't know. I'm not enough of an energy expert to know those things in advance. It's certainly, oil is still certainly a moneymaker for them. Gas is for now, in part because there are long-term contracts in some places. But But the real question is how to finance, you know, from a position where, you know, up till a financial crisis a few years ago, they were running huge budget surpluses every year and, you know, building up huge sovereign wealth funds. That's no longer the case. That's reduced revenues, but more it's increased expenditures. They're now not just spending on the military, but also a lot on infrastructure, on social welfare, and that sort of thing. And that budget discipline that, you know, people like the former finance minister, Alexei Kudrin, exemplified, this now kind of disappearing, which was probably the main reason that Kudrin resigned last year. So that raises the question of whether they're going to be able to fulfill their ambitious military rebuilding plans. And that's an open question. I don't think anybody really knows the answer. The plans are certainly grand. They certainly won't be achieved in full, but they never are, and that's okay. I think most countries' military building and expansion plans aren't fulfilled fully in the time allotted either. We see that in the U.S. with various weapon systems being late or cut back and so forth over the years. But in terms of whether how that affects the force structure, that becomes an interesting question. I think the way they would like to see their Navy is and the way they've sort of planned out the development is actually quite reasonable and rational, starting with renewing that coastal defense force, so having the smaller ships that are easier to build and can be built more cheaply. So they're well on their way to renewing the corvettes, the frigates, a little slower on the frigates, but they're getting there. And so that's kind of underway. Then the next step is down, you know, 10 years from now is to have new destroyers. And that's sort of still, you know, they're working on designs, but they haven't really come out yet. So we'll see. I think that they'd like to have that global naval presence, but it could fall victim to limited resources for sure. Every so often, you know, there's kind of pie in the sky kind of discussion of aircraft carriers and all that, and I don't believe any of it. I don't think they'll, you know, sure, 20 years from now they could have aircraft carriers, but there's so many variables between now and then that that's neither here nor there. For the moment, they have neither the resources to finance that nor the facilities to actually build the things, nor really a need for them. So that's kind of where they are now. To my mind, I think there are some people that think that might disagree and think that they are planning for this. I've heard people say that the reason they one of the reasons for buying the Mistrals and having a couple of them built in Russia was so they could refurbish the facilities in order to build aircraft carriers. Now, I do agree that it is one of the main reasons was in order to refurbish the facilities, but I think it's not in order to build aircraft carriers. It's in order to have a better, more modern shipyards to build other kinds of ships that are maybe those destroyers or other kinds of landing ships and basically more advanced kind of modular construction, more the ability to have more advanced electronics on their ships than they do on at present. And that's the kind of thing that they're going for there.
One of the thorns in the Russian side, at least from what the noise that you hear, was the anti-missile defense installing in Eastern Europe. You know, back at the end of the Bush administration, the big focus was in the Czech Republic and Poland, and the Obama administration has changed direction there slightly. Has the Russians' view on the anti-ballistic missile defenses deploying to Europe evolved in the last few years, or has it dropped down in their priority of concern?
I think it is still a concern. I'm not sure how much it's changed. I think they were certainly happy to see the changes and getting out of the northern central European countries, Czech and Poland and so forth. But they still, I think, you know, a large part of the people in the military who work on these kind of issues really don't buy the American explanation and do believe that on some level this is aimed at them, if not now, then later. And they see, well, the thinking goes that, well, sure, you know, when they start the system, it won't be sufficient to take out Russian nuclear weapons. But once it's there, it'll be much easier to expand it because the technology will be known. And so then, you know, once it's been tested and successful, then it could be used against Russia and we won't be able to stop it. So better to oppose it now, when it's still in the kind of planning stages, than to get caught out later on with little leverage. I think that's a lot of what's driving it, and then what follows is, well, if you're really, you know, the rhetoric of the type of, well, if you're really aimed at kind of rogue states or whatever, Iran, then why? Well, let's have a joint system. We don't want Iran launching nuclear missiles at Europe either. So we can let's have joint control and all those kind of things that they're saying that they know for various reasons, including purely domestic politics ones in the U.S., the U.S. can never accept. But, you know, that just to them reinforces the point that there may be other things going on. And, you know, sometimes when people go on Fox News or whatever and talk about the Russian threat, that, again, is heard in Moscow and reinforces that view as well. So there is kind of a feedback loop going on between what the discussion in the U.S. and the discussion in Moscow, and the two sides reacting to each other, and sometimes in positive ways, but more often in negative ways.
How much I'm one of the generation of the Cold War, at least the tail end of the Cold War, and maybe even more than the tail end of the Cold War. It was a while ago, but. How much, as I watch our younger generation of military people, most of whom have not served or did not serve during the Cold War, how much of a hangover is there in the Russian military from the Cold War attitudes that the U.S. is the big, I guess, their big enemy? Is that a concern, and is that generation going to slide out of their leadership sometime?
I think they are sliding out, and this is something, you know, if you'd asked me this question a few years ago, I'd have said, yeah, they're all kind of hidebound, you know, old fogies who, you know, dream of...
What are you saying exactly there, Jimmy?
I'm saying they are. just focused on, you know, refighting that the Cold War with NATO, but the military reform that's been going on really seems to me to be predicated on a recognition, at least among the political leadership, but I think that means also at least among a segment of the military leadership that advises the political, so that the threats, the real threats, are from elsewhere, and with the South in the short term Central Asia, Middle East, Caucasus, and China in the long term. And then that's where they've got to pivot, and that's why they have to shift their military to a more mobile structure initially to fight those kind of local regional conflicts. And then they still have to maintain their nuclear deterrent because that's the only, they know they have no hope against the Chinese army should there be a big war there, at least on a conventional level. So it's easy to keep talking about NATO in rhetoric because they know that there's a history there and people don't get offended as easily as they say if they started talking about how China is the big threat. That might not play well in Beijing and may cause more problems than it solves. So they actually kind of soft pedal that. But I think there are a lot of concerns about China down the road.
Yeah, if I was a young Russian military thinker, I would definitely be looking east, not west. I don't think they have to worry about a modern-day Napoleon trying to march from the west on Moscow.
Exactly.
They might have
and they're
somebody,
not stupid, they know that.
Yeah. There might, though, be some nationalist Chinese down the road who would really like to get eastern Siberia back that Russia took a little over a century ago, which I think from the Chinese point of view was yesterday. Speaking of China, the economic wonks who love acronyms, they love to talk about the BRIC company countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China. The South Africans try to run up and play with the big boys and call it BRICS with South Africa, but let's just stick with the usual BRIC. When you look at them, you have two more or less democratic societies with balanced economies. Somebody could say Brazil is a resource provider, but they're a little more balanced than that. You got Brazil and India, the B and the I. But then you have two, I think it'd be a stretch to call Russia a democracy in the Western sense, at least. Russia and China. Russia, obviously, very heavy resource provider. I remember as I was my last day in St. Petersburg, my Russian minder, as we were waiting to get on my boat, he looked over at the port there in St. Petersburg of all the metal ignits, and he said, "I don't know what happened to Russia. We used to make things. Now we just export things, but none of it's built." He missed the factories. But the Chinese are the big resource absorber, a big manufacturer. And it almost looks like, for somebody who wanted to look back a couple of decades, the old non-aligned movements, it's almost an economic non-aligned movement. So a lot of the same players that were in that organization during the Cold War are also in that little BRIC organization. They've had some meetings and some get-togethers. Do the Russians see any potential partnerships or gain from trying to make that little BRIC meeting and the BRIC countries work together in an economic sense as a balance to Western power, or is it seen as something that's just kind of neutral and something for economists to have fun with?
No, I think there's certainly a political aspect to it. I think from Russia's point of view, that, playing with those other countries is only good because of the reasons you mentioned, that they know that their economy is less balanced than the other ones, that they've been heading sure they've been growing for the last 10 years, but that's largely, as you say, export based on the export of natural resources rather than revitalization of manufacturing, at least for export. Still, a fair bit of domestic consumer goods being produced for domestic consumption, but that's not efficient. So Russia's been going in the, you might say, mostly, on average, in the wrong direction and holding even if you look at the whole post-Soviet period, whereas China has, and India have both, and Brazil have all experienced much stronger growth during that time. So hitching their wagon to that group can only be a good thing. And again, they want to be nice. They want to play nice with China. They're worried about them. They play nice with them in other environments, like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, for example. So there is, given how different those four countries are in economic terms, I don't know if it were purely about economics. I don't know what there'd be to gain from being from BRIC for any of them, or for Russia especially. But there is this political side where it's, and you hear these things every so often about, well, maybe we need to have an alternate reserve currency to the dollar or the euro, and that's the kind of thing that I think they see as a possibility from this kind of organization. Now, how real that is, I'm sort of skeptical. It go very far, because again, these countries have very different interests when it comes down to it. And when we see, even when with the EU in recent months, that even with countries that are much closer to each other and have more, much more in common, you end up going in different directions. And imagine it, if there was some, when push comes to shove, India, China, Brazil, and Russia aren't just not going to necessarily stick together. But in the meantime, it's useful for political posturing and some cooperation.
When I look at Russia, the size of it is just incredible, and I guess I'm wondering about how, is there any thought of exploiting their what seem to be the underpopulated regions, which are rich in all kinds of resources, by developing an infrastructure that includes more railroads, more highways, other systems of transportation to allow access into those areas, or is it just not in the cards that they will do that?
Well, I think if anything, those regions, and this is an argument that various people, I think Fiona Hill especially and Cliff Gaddy have made some years ago, is that those regions were, if anything, overpopulated in the Soviet days, because as we see in, let's say, in Alaska, for the U.S., you don't need a huge population to pump out resources. And you don't need a lot of, sure, you need some pipelines and you need, some railroads, roads maybe, but not necessarily. But they had, instead of taking the resources and shipping them elsewhere and then building with those resources in warmer places that were therefore cheaper to have larger populations, and they had a tendency to build a giant, nickel plant in Norilsk where the nickel was mined, rather than shipping it somewhere else. And so that restructuring is mostly, I think, completed. But I don't think that they necessarily want to reverse it and pump a lot of population into those areas. They'd rather have be bringing the resources out to the hospitable parts of Russia. So yes, certain kinds of infrastructure, certainly. Again, pipelines. I don't think there's any appetite for another giant railroad project, since they only sort of partially recently completed the Baikal-Amur Railroad, the second Trans-Siberian link. It's really difficult terrain. It's a lot of swamps, a lot of permafrost. Not the kind of place where you want to be building lots of railroads. It's just going to be really expensive perhaps not worth it.
Every time I look at a map of Russia, I have to keep reminding myself that I need to look at it not from an American perspective, but from a Canadian perspective, where you look at the population spread of Canada, which also looks really big. It's all right along that American border where the weather's a little better, a little nicer. And anybody that's flown over northern Canada, I guess Siberia is a lot this, a lot the same, where it's a bunch of nothing, or even at night there's just a little light here and there. It, coming from big land masses, coming back to a small land mass, I've always found accidents of history very interesting. And over in the Baltics, you know, you have Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, but you also have Russia has one of the Soviet Union's little war trophies left over, half of former East Prussia in Kaliningrad. And you know, after the fall of the Soviet Union, Kaliningrad was kind of a backyard of old military equipment, smugglers, and a little bit of crime. But it really is that the Hanseatic League didn't have that city there for no reason. It's in a pretty good space for commerce. How do the Baltics and Poland and Russia see as any type of potential in Kaliningrad, or is it still being treated as a backwater?
I think the real problem is the you know, the border regime. And I was just after my conference in Tartu, I took a little purely vacation kind of trip through the Baltics with my family, and we ended up in Nida, which is the southernmost tip of the Lithuanian part of the Curonian Spit. If you can picture that, so the bit that divides the lagoon from the Baltic Sea, and you know, the Lithuanian part of it is all tourism. So of the Curonian Spit. So you've got bike trails, you've got dunes, you've got we were still a couple months away from peak season, but there's a lot of stuff going on. But then it ends because there's a road that keeps going to Kaliningrad, and there's transport there. I saw a bus that the Klaipeda to Kaliningrad bus that went down that road. But you can't just kind of go back and forth because, you know, if you're, let's say, a citizen of a EU country or the United States, you can go to Lithuania, no problem, no visa required, just, you know, buy your ticket and show up. Not true for Russia. You can't just kind of pop over, even if it's, you know, you're a couple of kilometers away. So until that changes, and there is talk of liberalizing those visa regimes, and not just, you know, right now it's easy, you know, Kaliningrad, and Russians who live in Kaliningrad can get to Russia through Lithuania more easily than they used to, but that's not enough. If you want to sort of integrate Kaliningrad into the rest of the region, you really have to have something like open borders. You know, I drove from Estonia through to from Tallinn to Vilnius, and when you get to the border, there's some old abandoned looking buildings and nobody there because it's part of the EU, and that is what you need to integrate Kaliningrad really into the region. And I don't see that happening anytime soon for a whole bunch of fairly obvious reasons, I think. And until that happens, it's still going to be, to some extent, a military outpost, a fairly important one. But beyond that, kind of a, like you said, a backwater for economic purposes because it's cut off from the rest of Russia. And that, I think, makes it more of a backwater than it was in the Soviet days when it was. You know, whether you were in Kaliningrad or you were in Lithuania didn't matter so much in Soviet days.
You had a blog post up about Russia in the Arctic, and I kind of wanted to have you talk about that because I thought it was a really interesting piece. First, from their national security point of view, and then I wanted to kind of have you discuss the possible economic exploitation of what the area that Russia would claim in the Arctic. Could you kind of talk about that area?
Sure. There's a whole bunch of different directions where I could go in with that.
it's a shiny object.
Yes. The one thing that I think couple of years ago, I think a lot of people were worried that Russia was going to, the possibility of conflict in the Arctic was seen as increasing. We had that incident where they kind of demonstratively planted that platinum or whatever it was flag on the sea floor, and there was a lot of rhetoric that indicated that they were going to really aggressively pursue that. And then it all kind of died down. And what we saw instead was an effort to cooperate. So we saw an agreement, maritime border agreement with Norway signed that had been, an object of dispute for years and years. And so it seems to me that Russia, the Russian leadership recognized that they needed foreign assistance to, they were going to exploit some of the resources, the offshore energy resources there. They just don't have those capabilities on their own. And Norway is the country that has the most experience with extracting oil and gas, gas primarily, from those kind of fairly forbidding climatically northern reaches. So that I think was part of it. But the result is not just that they've settled that, but also they've ended up with an environment where the possibility of maritime transit through that northern sea route becomes more plausible, obviously because of global warming, but also because there's more cooperation among the states that border that route. So I think they're hopeful that they could see some economic gains from that region. It's a big shift because, if you read a lot of their kind of old Soviet military strategy kind of stuff, that was always kind of the iced over backstop, as it were, that they didn't have to worry about because nobody else could get there. Well, now people are going to be able to get there, but there is a greater sense of economic openness, so I think that they're okay with that. They certainly, they're increasing border guard units and some other kinds of military units up there to protect a more open space, which makes sense. But that's really where they see it heading down the road, is in a more kind of commercial direction rather than a military security one, which is, I think, also good.
Well, Dmitry, I'll tell you what, it has been a fast hour. I really appreciate you taking time this Sunday afternoon to spend with us again on MidRats. While we have a few seconds left here, what are you working on right now that people could expect to see from you concerning Russia and the near abroad?
Well, I'm just starting a study on reform of the defense industry, the Russian defense industry. So probably, we literally just got approval for it in the last couple of weeks, so I'm hoping sometime in the later fall to have something on that. And that's kind of the main project now. I've got a little short paper I'm going to write on the Kuril Islands, actually, on the positions of Russia and Japan on the Kuril Islands. That'll be something I'll be doing in the next month or so. So those are the two main things.
Well, excellent. Thanks again, and have a great springtime. Welcome back to the U.S.
Thanks. I've enjoyed this. It's been great. Look forward to doing it again sometime.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Dmitry.
And thanks for everybody who joined us live or getting us on the archive. Next week will be a Memorial Day best of. But coming up on the 3rd of June, we're going to have Mackenzie Eglin from the American Enterprise Institute. Then the 10th of June, we're going to have the Bon Vivant or Enfant Terrible, depending upon your point of view, of Disruptive Thinking, Peter Munson. Thanks again, everybody. Continue to enjoy your springtime, and the summer comes up, and I hope you all have a great Navy Day.
Piccadilly, or you'll be